Hello there. Today is Wednesday, August 9th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump warns North Korea over continued threats against the United States.
They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Trump promises to win the fight against opioid abuse in the U.S.
Like a rhinestone cowboy.
The world says goodbye to two well-known American performers. And also ahead, former Vice President Al Gore's Inconvenient sequel. It's out in theaters. We'll have a review. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, President Donald Trump on Tuesday issued a stark warning to North Korea.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
Trump, speaking to reporters at his private golf club in Bedminster, New Jersey, accused North Korean leader Kim Jong-un of having been threatening. The president's remark came just hours after several media outlets reported that the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency reached a conclusion last month that North Korea has successfully built a miniaturized nuclear warhead. It could fit inside its missiles. Other experts, though, have said in recent months that such an advancement by Pyongyang in its pursuit to build the world's ninth full-fledged nuclear power was probably years away. Joining me now for more perspective on this tense situation, Jenny Towne, assistant director at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University and managing editor at 38 North. First of all, thanks for being with us. What is your reaction to President Trump's comments?
It's a reckless statement, and I think it's very counterproductive in the process. It really backs the U.S. into a corner as well, as it does sort of create some reputational consequences for not acting on this threat. And I think it's a very dangerous way to approach the situation, again, knowing that North Korea, as part of their brinkmanship, always presents some verbal threats, especially verbal threats of retaliation for any kind of violence.
What would be a better way to handle something like that?
This has been going on for years. And, you know, this is the way that North Korea negotiates. You know, a more productive way to deal with this is, on some level, a non-response is more productive than any response, especially given the stated goals of U.S. policy. We are in a time of high tension already, and so agitating those tensions just through, you know, this verbal game of chicken going on is not going to reduce tensions. It's not going to reduce the threat. And if anything, it just escalates the situation where the potential for conflict becomes higher, and the risk of conflict, whether it's intentional or accidental, really escalate.
Is it also a mixed message? Because Monday we heard from the Secretary of State saying that, you know, dialogue was possible.
It completely undermines what the stated policy of the Trump administration is towards North Korea, this idea of maximum pressure and engagement. And the statements that Secretary Tillerson has been trying to say is really, you know, sending the message to North Korea that we are not your enemy, we don't seek regime change, we don't like what you're doing, we want you to stop. And we have to find a way in order to get you there, and whether that means sanctions or other coercive measures, you know, we want to find peaceful solutions. And so this has always been a problem with the Trump administration, is that you hear different messages from different actors, but the messages in the past have largely been more suggestive and innuendo, coming from various members of the cabinet, hinting at military options, hinting at regime change. But the stated policy and the message that we assume the administration was really trying to send through Secretary Tillerson now has no credibility.
How concerning is it with the news that North Korea has produced a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside missiles?
The assessments that have been leaked and the reports that came out, I don't think are completely reflective of what the entire intelligence community has consensus on. You know, we at 38 North have been reporting on this for a while, as have a few other technical experts that have been following North Korea's nuclear development. And the idea they're working on miniaturization capabilities and they've probably achieved some level of miniaturization is not a new revelation. Even in their September nuclear test last year, they had boasted that they had mastered miniaturization capabilities and now could produce in mass quantities, and that was their claim back then. So I think it's more the timing of these assessments being leaked.
So are you trying to say that this really isn't new, that we've already known this?
You know, honestly, it's not that new. We've known they're working on these capabilities. They've told us they have these capabilities. This is one of the reasons why North Korea is one of the high priorities of this Trump administration, is because their nuclear capabilities are growing. Just because they have nuclear weapons, of course, doesn't mean they intend to use them, and nor are they threatening to use them in an offensive capability. So, you know, the question becomes, you know, how then can we deal with the situation and find a way to get them to understand that, one, they don't need nuclear weapons, and two, it's against their interest to have them. And again, threatening them and threatening retaliation on them is not a very convincing argument for them to give up their nuclear deterrent capabilities.
Where do you see all of this going? Do you see a resolution? And will China be able to do anything to help us?
The China factor at this point, I think people overestimate the power that China has over North Korea to begin with. And this has been a long-standing problem. And yes, China has economic influence, but economic influence does not necessarily translate into political influence. And so, you know, I think China is doing more than they have in the past. And they seem to be willing to do some more. There's certainly a limitation on how far they're going to go because they need to protect their own strategic interests. But at the same time, they keep urging the U.S. to play its part as well. And part of that has to be getting back to a negotiation track, because this whole idea that we can intimidate North Korea and we can isolate North Korea and that will bring it back to negotiations on its own and will get it to change its behavior on its own and get it to rethink its strategic calculus just by threatening it and, you know, bolstering our own deterrence, this is the premise that's been going on for years now, and it doesn't work. North Korea, instead, it just strengthens their resolve to move forward to build up their deterrent capabilities.
I mean, do you ultimately feel like this will get resolved, or is this just going to continue to escalate?
If we don't get back to negotiations, I'm afraid it's going to continue to escalate. And, you know, because the Trump administration is more unpredictable than North Korea is, and I think this is a very dangerous factor right now, because it's hard to know, you know, how both sides are going to respond now to each other. And I think that makes for a very dangerous game of chicken we're playing at the moment.
That's Jenny Town, Assistant Director at the U.S.-Korea Institute at Johns Hopkins University. Thanks for being with us. Well, President Trump Tuesday also vowed that the U.S. would win the battle against the heroin and opioid epidemic, but stopped short of declaring a national emergency, as his hand-picked commission had recommended.
And I'm confident that by working with our healthcare and law enforcement experts, we will fight this deadly epidemic and the United States will win. We're also very, very tough on the southern border where much of this comes in.
Well, Trump spoke at an event. He had billed a major briefing on the opioid crisis during a 2-week working vacation at his private golf club in New Jersey. Speaking to the press alongside the president, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price explained the seriousness of the problem.
The numbers are absolutely daunting. 52,000 overdose deaths in 2015, 33,000 of those approximately related to opioids. The numbers in 2016 are no better, and the numbers in 2017 are even worse than 2016.
Well, Price also laid out a strategy to deal with it.
A strategy that includes making certain that we have the resources and the information necessary for prevention and treatment and recovery, providing best practices for states and those that are engaged in that process, making certain that we have overdose-reversing medication, naloxone and Narcan, as present as needed and possible anywhere across the country.
Well, last week, the Presidential Opioid Commission, chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, urged Trump to declare a national emergency and noted that America is enduring a death toll equal to September 11th every 3 weeks. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. South Africa's Zuma narrowly survives a no-confidence vote. U.S. diplomats advised to give generalized answers to the Paris climate deal questions. Democrats want to know about federal payments to Trump businesses. And social media posts could help diagnose depression. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, two breaking stories on Tuesday about two people who have had a great influence in the music world who have sadly passed away. First was Barbara Cook, known as the originator of the role Marion the Librarian in The Music Man. She was in Candide, a star of Broadway, a great singer, died at the age of 89 from respiratory failure. So lots of her fans celebrating her great work, lots of clips of her performances. And word coming out that Broadway is actually going to dim its lights on August 9th for a minute in honor of her. It's a honor that very few people get when they pass away, but one that means a lot to those in the Broadway community, especially those who have had such a big impact on the stage. So Barbara Cook certainly has had that, and her fans are remembering her on social media. And also Glen Campbell, country music singer, known for his songs Rhinestone Cowboy, Wichita Lineman, died at the age of 81 after suffering for years with Alzheimer's.
Right. And I remember when he first was diagnosed, he came out and told fans that he wouldn't be performing anymore.
And there was a documentary about his Alzheimer's battle that a lot of people are talking about on social media. Again, for both of these, these celebrities were seeing the same kind of reaction on social media. A lot of remembrances, condolences, clips of their music, of their performances, two people that will very much be missed.
And let's listen to a little bit of Glen Campbell.
Like a rhinestone cowboy, riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo.
Great song, loved by a lot of people.
He was one of a kind, and he will be sorely missed for sure.
Definitely.
Anything else happening that we should know about on social media?
Yeah, the other big story on Tuesday into Wednesday is, of course, the election in Kenya, that country voting for its president. And social media played a huge role throughout the election process. We saw a lot of campaigning and advocacy going on social media. On the day of the election, we saw the two presidential candidates tweeting out photos of them voting. So social media has played a big role in that regard, in the publicity for the election. But it's also played a big role in stopping voter suppression and fighting voter fraud. And there's a service based in Nairobi called Ushahidi. It's the Swahili word for testimony. And what it allows people to do is report these instances via social media, and they get mapped out and investigated. What's interesting with this election is that people can actually report these instances through Facebook Messenger. So if someone witnesses voter fraud or they're unable to vote for some reason, they can actually, through Facebook Messenger, send a message to Ushahidi and have that mapped out and investigated. So it's a great service to fight these instances, and it's a great way to use social media to preserve the integrity of this election. It's something I think we've seen more and more of around the world, social media not just being used as the candidates publicize their campaigns, but used as something to actually stop instances of illegal vote tampering or fraud.
Yeah, that is one election that is certainly getting a lot of attention.
Indeed. And even before the election, a lot of the social media companies in Kenya stepping up to stop the spread of fake news. That's something we've talked about a lot in the U.S. election. And unfortunately, I think that's another thing we're going to see more of around the world, is the spread of misinformation and fake news in elections. However, I think that social media is going to continue to step up to try to fight that.
All right, Andrew, we appreciate it. Thanks. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And speaking of social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, they allow us to share aspects of our lives with our friends, family, and the world. But does what we're sharing say, what does it say about our state of mind? Some new research suggests that it may be telling the world a lot more than we think. Kevin Enix has that story.
We live in the age of sharing. Events, great and small, moments, big and little, become chapters in the book of our online lives. It turns out some of the information you're sharing may be saying more about you than you think, says Chris Danforth via Skype.
Yeah, I think that, you know, with so much more of our life happening on the internet these days and the ubiquity of mobile phones in our lives, there's just a lot more that we're revealing about our behavior maybe than we're even aware of.
The mathematician and his colleague Peter Dodds created some machine learning tools to analyze people's Instagram posts.
We found out basically that you know, people who had been diagnosed with depression, their pictures tended to be darker and bluer and grayer. If they chose to use a filter, it tended to be the black and white filter, Inkwell. That's the one they chose more often than any others.
You can see the differences in some of the images Danforth analyzed. Grayer blue filters versus the vibrant colors of the originals just look, well, depressing.
It's not new news that people who are depressed see the world in darker colors, spend less time in social groups. But you know, being able to infer this from social media, that was something new.
Danforth says it could lead the way to an app that alerts your doctor when you're in emotional trouble.
Maybe 5 to 10 years from now, if studies like the one we've done here, you know, they bear fruit in larger groups and they're reproduced, you know, you could imagine installing an app, downloading an app that you consent to having your data shared with your physician so they can know when it's time to see you sooner.
Danforth points out there are also huge privacy concerns involved and that more research is needed to figure out how well machines can diagnose a human's state of mind. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
VOA's International Edition continues now with a look at the latest movies to hit U.S. theater. And for that, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Let's start with The Dark Tower. What's that about?
Well, The Dark Tower is from a very popular series of Stephen King books. And it's been, for years, they've been trying to adapt these novels to the big screen. They've gone through different directors and producers and production companies. It's like trying to adapt the Bible, for crying out loud. There's so much content in there. Where do you cut? Where do you do? How do you put it down to a two-hour movie? And they didn't screen this for critics. So I went and paid for this movie on my own, not only because it's a big film, you know, from Columbia Pictures, from Sony, but also, you know, I'm a Stephen King fan. I want to see what they did with this because they had some great actors. You know, Idris Elba plays the gunslinger, who's like one of the last of his kind that's protecting this dark tower. And the tower protects all of the realms, you know, our world and the next world beyond from evil. And the personification of evil in the movie is Matthew McConaughey. He plays the Man in Black. And he wants to find a certain child that has a specific psychic energy that can bring down this tower. And if you know Stephen King's books like The Shining, the little boy had the shine. Well, this he keeps that motif going through The Dark Tower, and this little boy that stars in the film has the shine from, you know, the greatest they've ever seen. So, of course, the gunslinger finds him, and he's got to protect him, and Matthew McConaughey will stop at nothing to get revenge and to get this little boy to bring down the tower, and then all of evil will encompass everything. So it's a little kind of a complicated fantasy plot right there. And that was one of my problems with the movie because it had so many different genres in it. It had the Western. It had the fantasy like Lord of the Rings. It had science fiction because they travel between our world and the next realm using portals. They're like jumping through with computers and stuff. So I was really confused with the story. I'm like, what is going on here? So I really didn't understand what was going on, but the performances were great, and so was the special effects. I felt this movie should have been given more time to develop like a miniseries from HBO, like Westworld, something where it could really satisfy fans and flesh out these characters because they were fascinating. But unfortunately, since the movie was so confusing, I can't give it a great rating because I'm still trying to, I can't even explain to you what was going on. I don't know why.
And let's get to Al Gore's new An Inconvenient sequel, a sequel to his Inconvenient Truth. And you actually had the opportunity to meet him. So tell us all about it.
Yes, I was really excited. He's actually a phoner. I got to do a phone interview with him.
Okay.
And I got him on his satellite tour. But, you know, in my 20-year history as a critic, you know, I can count on one hand some of the interviews that highlighted my career. This was definitely one of them, speaking with Al Gore. And, you know, here it has been 12 years since his first movie, and he was pretty much the champion of bringing this to everybody's attention of climate change. You know, it's been around since the 70s with all the scientists, so it's been around a long time saying that mankind is changing the temperature of the Earth and have catastrophic results. He was the first one to bring it to the public and say, look, we've got to do something. And, of course, bringing awareness was the first movie he used a slideshow. This time around, 12 years later, he's got new filmmakers. He's been traveling the world for the last few years, getting interviews with world leaders, showing climate change as it's happening, and not only just being gloom and doom, but showing solutions, too, you know, with solar panels and all the renewable energies that have come aboard. You know, with China taking the lead on all of this, not only with business and economics, but also cleaning up their air. So don't let anyone tell you that no one around the world there isn't doing anything. They're all jumping into action far up, you know, beyond anyone's comprehension, except the United States, because of President Trump pulling out of the Paris Treaty Accords. But you got to understand that the world isn't listening to our president, which is good, because everyone agrees that global warming does exist and climate change is happening. And, you know, from this country and other countries, you can't stop it. There's no way to turn the tide on it. And Al Gore had to change the end of his documentary because they were finishing it up for Sundance Film Festival when the president pulled out of the Paris Treaty. And Al Gore was one of the critical negotiators in that. And to get all the countries in the world to agree on that was just nothing short of phenomenal. And also what's another great aspect of the Inconvenient sequel is that he shows a call to arms. He shows that what you can do, what has been done, the progress we made in just 12 years since his first documentary, and not only that, younger people, the next generation, are so important to take this topic and take this task and run with it. So he tells, there's so much inspiration in this movie, and it's good to see that, you know, something's being done, but there's a lot of work to be done still.
Is it difficult to watch?
I'm a documentary fan. I'm a climate supporter, you know, so I think watching the movie, again, he does kind of, you know, scare you, but then he doesn't leave you going, good luck, you know.
Right.
He says, look, here's what's being done. Here's what's being done for the future. Mm-hmm. Here's where China is making electric cars within the next 5 to 10 years. All their cars will be electric. It's mandated. That's more than America's doing. And not only that, he goes to just places in the South, just red states, that are saying, oh, no, we're taking up all what the climate change recommendations by the Paris Treaty Accords, and we're implementing them. And we're saving money. We're creating jobs. We're creating industry here.
All right. Well, we'll have to take a look at that movie for sure. Thank you so much. That's Jeffrey K. Howard. And you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Well, keeping our focus on the world of entertainment, we're joined now by Rare.us content editor Nicole Michella. So, Nicole, we've been talking a lot in the past few weeks about the late Princess Diana in light of the 20th anniversary of her untimely death. Now, we did hear a lot about her sons and from her sons, Prince William and Prince Harry, and how they're remembering their mother. And I understand Diana's brother is also revealing some pretty intimate feelings of his own.
Her brother, Charles, the 9th Earl of Spencer, has partaken in a new documentary about her life, and he is talking about the day she died and the days after her death, and how he felt very protective of her when they were children and felt like there could have been or should have been something he could do to prevent it. And he says that he felt this immense guilt for a long time after her death. And something he actually said in the documentary that I didn't know before personally was that Diana kind of destigmatized royals touching commoners in a way. He said that she never liked wearing gloves. And if you look at old photos of her with HIV/AIDS patients or just anybody, if she was sitting in a nursing home or anything like that, she is physically touching the other person in a lot of those photos. So he talked about how she didn't like to wear gloves, and she really showed her compassion by physical touch. And her work in HIV/AIDS has been kind of almost inherited in a way by Prince Harry. He has continued her legacy in that work and has continued to try to destigmatize the disease by doing things like getting a live HIV test on Facebook and doing one again a few months later with Rihanna. So Charles is very, very proud of his nephews and thinks that Diana would have been so proud of her boys.
And you've got some news about something going on with Jessica Alba.
Yeah, Jessica Alba and her family are having a little bit of a tough time. She announced this week that they lost their beloved dog, Bowie. They had him for a long time, and this death comes just 2 weeks after they lost their other dog, Sid, that was this cute little pug.
Oh, no.
So the whole family's kind of mourning their family pets. Mm-hmm. Bowie died after Jessica came back from a press tour in New York, and when Sid died, the family had just been on vacation in Hawaii together, so it's a tough time for her and her girls, but happier times, I think, are on the horizon because she is expecting baby number 3. So while it's a tough time for them right now, happy times are coming for the family.
I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Remembering the late Glenn Campbell, that was Rare.us content editor Nicole Moschella. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime you want at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a good day.
By the time I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing off the wall. That's all. By the time I make Oklahoma, she'll be sleeping.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
August marks the 3rd anniversary of the assault by ISIS terrorists on the Yazidi community in northern Iraq, during which they sought to destroy this people and their culture. The brutality of the events marked both a disaster for the Yazidi community and a turning point in the fight against ISIS. On August 3, 2014, ISIS terrorists overran the city of Sinjar in northern Iraq. The town had a population of 90,000 people, most of them Yazidis, with a small Shia minority. Yazidis are a non-Muslim religious and ethnic minority. They have been viciously targeted and persecuted by ISIS for their beliefs and have been frequently attacked throughout their history by others. When ISIS seized control of Sinjar and the surrounding countryside, they immediately began to destroy Yazidi shrines and to slaughter Yazidi civilians. Thousands of people, particularly men and boys, were executed, while thousands more, especially women and girls, were abducted and raped as sex slaves by ISIS fighters. Of the 200,000 people who fled their homes in the city and the surrounding villages, some 50,000 took refuge on Mount Sinjar. There they were surrounded and trapped by ISIS fighters. Within 3 days, dozens of Yazidis, nearly all of them children, began to die of dehydration. They called family around the world, including in America, begging for help to escape the siege. On August 4, 2014, the Emir of Yazidi called on the world leaders for assistance. The United States responded, conducting airstrikes against ISIS militants, supporting the delivery of humanitarian assistance through airdrops of food and water, and working with Iraqi and other partners. This was the first action that led to the formation of the International Coalition to Defeat ISIS and the beginning of the end for ISIS. By mid-December of 2014, Kurdish forces launched the first phase of the campaign to expel ISIS from Sinjar, liberating parts of Sinjar City before the year's end. On November 13, 2015, a day after launching a second offensive, Kurdish and Yazidi forces, backed by coalition airstrikes, fully regained control of Sinjar from ISIS. The fight against ISIS is a fight of civilization against barbarism. Nowhere was this more clearly demonstrated than in Sinjar.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.